Up to this point, we've talked about a couple of aspects of Frost. First, his humor. We spent a couple of days talking about his humor and had some fun with that. But that's a fairly arbitrary kind of grouping of his poems, since most of his poems have an element of humor, particularly if we define humor in its broadest sense, in having some element of surprise that delights us. It often delights us in a way that borders on humor, in that it tickles our funny bone, makes us want to laugh or at least smile. The second category was a discussion of how he worked, how he saw the creation of poetry. And we talked there about two aspects particularly. First, his desire to have the poem seem spontaneous. He said at one point, for example, and I didn't mention this, that the secret of writing poems is to have every poem different from every other poem that's ever been written. And then he thought that all the lines of a poem should flow directly from spoken speech. Come on in, there are some chairs over here, and just barge right in and make yourselves at home. Come on in, we'll find some seats, if a couple more in back here, a couple up front here. Get my stuff off this one. So we've talked about humor, and we've talked about how he worked, and I want to continue to talk a little about how he worked today and to move into his nature poetry, which is a fascinating category, since he was an outdoors person, a country person, a farmer of sorts, not a very serious farmer. He never was a successful farmer. He liked to play at farming. Let's see, have we got any extra seats? There's one over back here, Phyllis, if you want, or Ruth. And there's one over here. And pull it where you want to pull it, Ruth, so you'll be comfortable. Let me bring this forward so I'm not laying with my back to anybody here. I should mention a book that I've been using for most of the poems, and this is available in the bookstore. That's a plug. We've got some places over here on these tables if you want to take a seat on one of them. This is an anthology of his poems by Louis Untermeyer, who was a friend of his, a very good poet in his own right, and a fine critic of poetry. And he has some good comments on a number of the poems, which I'm sure some of you have discovered, that are kind of fun, by way of introduction. They're brief, they're succinct, they're very perceptive. I really like them. So I recommend this to you. There is also a smaller book, and this one, by the way, costs $4.95, a relatively good buy, right? I selected it specifically because of its price. I know that poor students never have very much money for their texts, so if you want to purchase this, it's at the reasonable price of $4.95. This one costs you 50 cents. How's that for economy? 50 cents, and this has 7 good Frostian poems with, again, a bit of commentary in them. And this is also available in the Village bookstore. But it is by no means necessary that you have the poems in front of you. Indeed, Frost would have preferred that you hear the poems first. He thought that poetry should come through the ear, that one should hear it first and then perhaps read it. But he wanted the impact to be an oral impact. So don't feel bad if you do not have the poems in front of you. There is a poem that I do want to have us read, which relates in part at least to how he functioned as a poet, how he worked. But this was requested yesterday by a student. And I refer to us all as students, right? We're all students, we're all in the process of learning about Frost's poetry. This poem is Home Burial. Who was it who asked for Home Burial? Somebody? Okay. There are two nice rolls in this little poem. which I would like to ask for volunteers to read. We had some nice readers yesterday. And maybe you'd be interested in reading the woman's role. Would you do that?
That would be great. Do I have a gentleman who would be interested in reading the man's role? And I'm going to give you a little time to read it through while I do a couple of other things first. So you know the poem, but...
I haven't read it for 25
yeah,
years.
Yeah, right. So I want to give you a chance to read it while I do a couple of other things, but I would like to give you a chance to prep it. Is there a man who would like to play this nice role, and all you're really doing is just reading it? It's fairly straightforward. Sir, thank you. Put the mark in there for it. You can take a few minutes to read through it if you'd like to do that while I talk about some other things, particularly relating to his nature poems. Let's take a look at a few of the nature poems. Let's take a look at the one on page 89, which is maybe of all his poems the best known. This is Birches. Does somebody have the book who would be willing to read it for us? Thank you.
When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay. Ice storms do that. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves. As the breeze rises and turns many colored, as the stir cracks and traces their enamel, soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crest, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once they are bowed, so long, so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground, like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon and not clearing the tree away, clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you see to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches? And so I dream of going back to thee. It's when I'm weary of considerations, and life is too much like a pathless wood, where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant that I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the trees could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches.
Thank you very much. Very nicely done. This is a typical Frost nature poem in that while it describes a lovely picture of nature, man is not absent. men and women appear in his nature poems, often solo, as this young lad does, but it is the experience of the human being in nature that interests Frost most. He wasn't a writer who would take a scene and simply describe it, or an event that transcends human involvement. No, he was more interested in people. And often they appear to be Frost himself. Here's the younger Frost, I think. He's describing what happened to him. I suspect he was a pretty good swinger of birches himself while he was a kid. And I like the way he describes the isolation of the kid. Your heart goes out to a kid like this, way out there in the hills of New Hampshire. No other boys to play with, not even any girls to play with. Just himself, all alone. And so he must make his own games, and he finds this wonderful, exciting, moderately dangerous, and therefore adventuresome game of going up the tree, finding the right weight when he can swing it all the way down to the ground by swinging and not going too high so that he destroys the tree, and not starting too low so that he just gets it halfway down, then he's got to climb back himself, which is dangerous. So he's learned how to do it. Any reactions to the poem? Any thoughts that you have on it?
Do you think it's autobiographical?
I suspect it is. I suspect it is. There's no particular grounds for saying it, because he says in there, I was once a swinger of birches, and I'd like to be again. That's the only clue I have. He never specifically said so that I know. Do you think so, Phyllis? Does it strike you as?
I think so.
Yeah, there's nostalgia in it, I think. Nostalgia. He's looking back on his own boyhood when he used to do this. He was a boy in New England. He was born in San Francisco, curiously, but he came back. His father died when he was a young boy, and his mother's folks were from Lawrence, Massachusetts, and she took him and his sister back to Lawrence, where he grew up, and then moved early in his young manhood to New Hampshire and spent most of his subsequent life in New Hampshire and Vermont. So he was a New Englander, and this is a kind of a New England type poem, although it could transpire in Washington State, I'm sure. We have birches here, we have boys here, we have adventuresome lads and lasses. Shouldn't wonder, this could be a girl too, a young girl as well as a boy. It's got a meter which is itself relatively free. One could read it with a bit more impact. Let me read just a couple of lines and we can see some of that rhythm. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay. Ice storms do that. See, now we've got to stop. We've got a little irregularity in here because that's the way speech is. He would feel that if it were too sing-song, in that sing-song pattern, that it would commence to be unlike speech. You can have a certain amount of that, but everything we've said before could have been a line that somebody spoke, I think you'll agree. So he needs to break it so it doesn't become too sing-songy, which would then make it unlike spoken speech, and that wouldn't satisfy him. So he's relatively free to handle the verse, the rhythm, the tempo, as he sees, breaking up the pattern. He's by no means slavishly aping some form that had been metrically set down. Although in the poem that I charted up here, he did a more regular rhyme scheme. This has very little rhyme, just a kind of what we call slant rhyme, so that the words sound a little alike at the ends of the words, but it's by no means central to the poem. He felt there needed to be order, there needed to be form. It couldn't be free verse by which you follow no rule. You remember I mentioned that he said that was like playing tennis without a net, his scornful assertion about free verse, which was all the rage when he was a young poet. Lots of the most avant-garde poets, the most popular poets, were writing free verse, really without any form, whatever. And he thought that was a paradox, like playing tennis without a net, with no challenge. Any other comments on it? Yes. Yes. I think in that way he was very human, very normal, wasn't he? I think most of us feel that way, don't you? One of the things that I like about Holden is the times that I can go up by myself and take a walk. The social interrelationships of the village are very intense, and that's part of the fun. But also it lends itself, Holden does, to all these places one can go by oneself, in the buildings too, and find a spot, but particularly out in the nature, out in this beautiful surrounding. So I think he was like us in that. He was a very social fellow, very social person, although later on in life he always wanted to be the center of attention. He one time said, when somebody said, "Are you going to go to such a meeting where such and such a person is speaking?" He said, and he spoke sometimes in poetry. Listen to his response. "I only go when I'm the show." Pretty good line. And he used that fairly frequently. In fact, I've heard him use the line. "I only go when I'm the show." He didn't necessarily want to go and listen to somebody else. No, he had to be the center of attention. He had a lot of ego. He had a lot of ego, indeed. Well, he actually was asked to speak at JFK's inauguration and read a poem there, and that was the first time a poet had ever been asked to a presidential inauguration. He was very proud of that. He loved that moment. Indeed, it was maybe the... No, I think he felt that he was pretty much the show for that moment. He was certainly, and you may remember that he had a poem that he was going to read that he wrote specifically for the inauguration, and I remember this vividly. The glare of the sun was such that, and the wind was such that he couldn't read it. So he recited the poem, The Gift, outright, upon which that poem that he had written was based, and it was a kind of an addition to that poem. Yeah, he was the show enough at that. He was the cynosure sufficient, I think. Should we have the home burial now? Would you folks come on up? I'd appreciate you coming up. I don't have to be the show. I'm willing to share the show. I'm a much more modest, humble sort of person. I think you can sense that. Okay, now I am going to read. I will read the parts between the roles, and my two colleagues will be reading the parts of the young man and young woman recently bereaved. They've lost their firstborn, and their reaction to this loss is what's at issue in the poem. And they are rather typical New England young marrieds running a farm, lots of work to do. It's been the family farm, his family's farm, for generations. And I guess that's all I need to tell you. I think the rest of the poem will stand for itself. And I want you to listen to the lines and perceive the degree to which Frost has followed his own dictum of having every line sound like spoken speech, especially and dramatically when the young man and his wife are conversing. Their lines are just those you might hear in such a situation, especially in New England. Home burial. He saw her from the bottom of the stairs before she saw him. She was starting down, looking back over her shoulder at some fear. She took a doubtful step and then undid it to raise herself and look again. He spoke, advancing toward her.
"What is it you see from up there always? For I want to know."
She turned and sank upon her skirts at that, and her face changed from terrified to dull. He said, to gain time,
"What is it you see?"
Mounting until she cowered under him.
"I will find out now. You must tell me, dear."
She in her place refused him any help. With the least stiffening of her neck and silence, she let him look, sure he wouldn't see, blind creature. And a while he didn't see, but at last he murmured,
"Oh."
And again,
"Oh."
"What is it? What?"
she said.
"Just that I see."
"You don't,"
she challenged.
"Tell me what it is."
"The wonder is I didn't see at once." I never noticed it from here before. I must be wonted to it. That's the reason. The little graveyard where my people are, so small the window frames the whole of it. Not so much larger than a bedroom, is it? There are 3 stones of slate and 1 of marble, broad-shouldered little slabs there in the sunlight on the hill, side hill. We haven't to mind those. But I understand. It is not the stones, but the child's mound.
Don't,
she cried. She withdrew, shrinking from beneath his arm that rested on the banister, and slid downstairs and turned on him with such a daunting look, he said twice over before he knew himself,
"Can't a man speak of his own child he's lost?"
"Not you. Oh, where's my hat? Oh, I don't need it. I must get out of here. I must get air. I don't know rightly whether any man can."
"Amy, don't go to someone else this time. Listen to me. I won't come down the stairs."
He sat and fixed his chin upon his fists.
"There's something I should like to ask you, dear."
"You don't know how to ask it."
"Help me then."
Her fingers moved the latch for all reply.
"My words are nearly always an offense. I don't know how to speak of anything so as to please you. But I might be taught, I should suppose. I can't say I see how. A man must partly give up being a man with women folk. We could have some arrangement by which I'd bind myself to keep my hands off anything special you're mine to name, though I don't like such things twixt those that love. Two that don't love can't live together without them, but two that do can't live together with them."
She moved the latch a little.
Don't go. Don't carry it to someone else this time.
I'm sorry.
That's me,
isn't
it?
Oh, yeah.
Don't go. Don't carry it to someone else this time. Tell me about it, if it's something human. Let me into your grief. I'm not so much unlike other folks as your standing there apart would make me out. Give me my chance. I do think, though, you overdo it a little. What was it brought you up to think it the thing to take your mother's loss of a first child so inconsolably in the face of love? You'd think his memory might be satisfied.
There you go, sneering now.
I'm not. You make me angry. I'll come down to you. God, what a woman. And it's come to this. A man can't speak of his own child that's dead.
You can't because you don't know how to speak. If you had any feelings, you that dug with your own hand, how could you, his little grave? I saw you from that very window there, making the gravel leap and leap in the air, leap up like that, and land so lightly, and roll back down the mound beside the hole. I thought, who is that man? I don't know you. And I crept down the stairs and up the stairs to look again, and still your spade kept lifting. Then you came in. I heard your rumbling voice out the kitchen, and I don't know why, but I went near to see with my own eyes. You could sit there with the stains on your shoes of the fresh earth from your own baby's grave and talk about your everyday concerns. You had stood the spade up against the wall outside there in the entry, for I saw it.
I shall laugh the worst laugh I ever laughed. I'm cursed. God, if I don't believe I'm cursed.
I can repeat the very words you were saying. 3 foggy mornings and 1 rainy day will rot the best birch fence a man can build. Think of it. Talk like that at such a time? What had how long it takes a birch to rot to do with what was in the darkened parlor? You couldn't care. The nearest friends can go without anyone to death. Comes so far short, they might as well not try to go at all. No, from the time when one is sick to death, one is alone, and he dies more alone. Friends make pretense of following to the grave, but before one is in it, their minds are turned and making the best of their way back to life, and living people and things they understand. But the world's evil. I won't have grief, so if I can change it, oh, I won't.
There. You have said it all and you feel better. You won't go now. You're crying. Close the door. The heart's gone out of it. Why keep it up? Amy, there's someone coming down the road.
You? Oh, you think the talk is all. I must go somewhere out of this house. How can I make you?
If you do...
She was opening the door wider.
Where do you mean to go? Tell me that. I'll follow and bring you back by force. I will.
Thank you. Very nice. Reactions to that? Comments on it?
Even though it sounds like spoken speech, the lines that they of the characters, there is a lot of description and stuff that no one would really ever say in conversation. But well, like the gravel flying up, and her talking about that, and I thought, but it worked really well. I mean, it didn't make it unrealistic.
Yeah, the art is in taking the spoken speech and then elevating it, but having it sound, as you say, like spoken speech. And the detail which she is observing is so carefully observed, because she feels so intensely that he could simply be shoveling and throwing the earth up and casually just letting it fly where their baby's body will lie. She just can't. Anything that's very specific and earthy about what he's doing, the mud on his shoes, she sees as just such a paradox. Here's this cataclysmic event which has transpired, and he's got mud on his shoes, and he's thrown the dirt up in a rhythmic way. He's a good digger, you can tell. There's this paradox which she can't deal with, of the earthy thing of the dirt flying up, and yet the whole world has rocked and almost come apart at the seams for her. Yes?
Yeah. A young couple, friend of ours, lost their first baby with SIDS after 6 months. And, I mean, I thought I was hearing in that poem. I've not heard that poem before. And it was what happens. It was the way the young husband and young wife reacted so differently that almost destroyed their marriage. And fortunately, they came through it. Ross knows it.
Mm-hmm. This kind of event can destroy marriages, can destroy families. It's a kind of a searing test. Yes?
Well, my background's Scandinavian, and I think that in you know, the Yankee background and Scandinavian background, men are really taught to repress their feelings and to just concentrate on the work, and then that gets frustrating for women that want to share their feelings, but the men have been taught not to. And I think that's something that my husband is a Scandinavian, is struggling with, maybe the Scandinavian Yankee type.
Yes. What is it he says? A man must give up his manhood a little to live with women.
Mm-hmm. And I think that a Latin would have responded differently in that situation.
I think that's right. A man would perhaps be more involved in the emotional release, and maybe that would have been healthier. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He probably found his release in a physical way.
Yeah.
This seemed to me it could be angry.
Oh, yes, getting rid of it. Getting rid of his feeling with that forceful work. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, and I think that's healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is the culmination of a series of days when this, and maybe even weeks, probably weeks, since the event, and so he has tried to relate, and she's got angrier and angrier at him, I sense.
She didn't want to have.
You have the sense that these are not very articulate people, and being a bit more articulate, and indeed, not only they're not articulate, maybe articulateness is not as important, but they're taciturn people. These New Englanders are very taciturn people. They really don't say much. I think I gave you the analogy the other day that I've always thought was the quintessence of a New England reaction related to death, and it's the two old New Englanders talking one to another about a third friend, another old friend, and one of them says to the other, "John's dead. He died yesterday. He didn't want much said about it." That's real taciturnity, right? I mean, how taciturn can you get? And how taciturn can John get? I mean, I don't want anybody to say anything about it. Don't talk about it, you know. I'm about to go, but I'd rather not have anything said about it.
What I sensed was her greatest frustration is after he had dug this grave, how he could come in and talk about a fence rotting.
Yes.
That was just so unbelievable where the baby is laying right there in the house. And
yes.
How can you talk about anything about that? That was so overwhelming.
Yes. Yes, he's a country man. He talks about country things. It might have been better for them if they'd had somebody to talk to. Even old Silas from The Hired Man, which we read yesterday, would have been good to have him around so they could have an intermediary, since they're very much alone dealing with this, don't you? These two people, and it's very, they're probably newly married. They probably don't know each other very well. They're probably young, quite young probably. They could be 20, 19, young kids getting married, and particularly in the earlier part of this century, they would be married quite young, right after high school typically, as the young couple were in our town. The play always kind of reminds me of our town, this little play that I see in this charming little poem. They are like those New Hampshireites, simple folks. And his approach to it is pragmatic. Life must go on. He's probably got some gravestones up there in the graveyard of young firstborns or third or fourth or fifthborns who died, because it was the pattern, of course, in the 19th century. Before penicillin, it was not unusual to have children die. Before the 30s, to have lots of children die. It was just part of the way the world works. And he sort of had that embedded in him. Maybe she's a town girl. Maybe she hasn't grown up with this. Maybe she's from Littleton or Hanover or one of those small towns, and she hasn't experienced, even vicariously in her family, the young children who don't make it through the first year. Yes, Phyllis?
Toward the end of the poem, I noticed the bottom 29, she starts speaking in more general terms of, she goes to, well, one treats death this way. She kind of removes it from a personal attack on her husband and says, friends make pretense of falling to the grave, but before one is in it, their minds are turned. So she's making a more generalized statement of how people treat death lightly.
Yes.
They pretend that they're going to be with you to the end, but ultimately they all die alone.
Friends can't. And not only do we die alone, but our most immediate relatives must deal with it alone. Friends come and try to be helpful, but she's transferring her bitterness there, it seems to me, a little bit. She's also bitter against them. They came and tried to help, but they couldn't help. I don't know even why they bothered to try. Life is terrible. Life is cruel. Maybe she hasn't had this experience before, and it's tougher for him than it is for her than it is for him.
I won't have grief so if I can change it.
Yeah.
She herself is going to take that grieving to the limit.
Yes. Quite right. Yes?
I'm a nurse and I work with a lot with parents who lose children, and one of the things I say to them when they leave the hospital is that oftentimes the man can go back to work. And so his life doesn't change very much. But for a woman, she's been expecting to be a mother and to take care of his child. And so her grieving is much more real, and she can't get away from it.
Mm.
And so when I talk to them, I say, you need to share your feelings with one another so that even if it appears that your husband is not grieving, you need to share that so that he can help you. And it seems like that's what this man was trying to do.
Yes, yes. Do you think this is going to work out? Are they going to work their way through this? What do you think?
Yes, I think it's better. Mm-hmm. Not in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. What's going to happen right now, do you think? Is she going to go, and is he going to have actually use physical force to bring her back in? This is not the first time this altercation has transpired. This has happened several times. Is that gonna work?
I don't think she's ready for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's what she needs, though. So strong comfort, something solid.
But something's happened because he he's talking about it now. He's saying, don't take it to somebody else.
Yeah.
He was really reaching out to her.
He was indeed. But at the very end, when he says, if you do, and then he says, I will, you sense that he's pretty strongly motivated now to take charge here. And I have a suspicion maybe he will, and maybe that's going to make it all right. And maybe not. Maybe not.
If someone said, try to control my emotions or control where I was going to be, I would be very angry. Because I like to sometimes go off and experience my pain alone at times where I cannot be around others, because it's like my mind will not calm down when I'm with other people.
Mm. But she's done this several times, hasn't she? How long? I guess the question is, how long can you do that? And I'd be interested in your reaction to that. How long can she keep turning away from him without having that itself be a real, really divisive kind of action on her part?
She can do it for a long time. Breathing goes on and on. We recommend that parents not consider having another baby for a year to get through that breathing process.
I see, yeah. Mm-hmm.
As long as he can continue to recognize where she is and to offer his support, even if she doesn't take it, it's still helpful.
So they're at a real crunch point, aren't they? I mean, that's why this is such a dramatic poem. Mm-hmm. Everything that's been said suggests that we're really at a key point in their relationship. Roland?
Is there any significance to someone coming up the road?
Yeah, how about that? How about that? What do we feel? Is somebody coming up the road? Why does he react that way, and what does that say?
Let's shut up. Let's not deal with this in front of other people.
This is a private matter. This is private, and we mustn't... I think that's kind of a natural reaction, isn't it, right? I never have any fights with my wife, but I think if I did, I might say, there's somebody coming. Shh, shh, shh. I'm just kind of imagining it because it never happens to me. Right? You had a comment, did you? No. Okay. Any other thoughts on it? Shall we? Yes, please. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to say a while ago when he was speaking of the fence, I think that was his means of escape at that particular moment. You know, get my mind on something else.
He's not drawing an analogy at all with the decay of the child, but she draws that inference, you see, and she's thinking, she probably doesn't know the word obtuse, she might not know the word or use the word obtuse, but how obtuse can you be to use that analogy? He's just talking of country things. He's just turning back to his world. He's going back to work, you see, and his work is the farm. And her work is in the house, and what's she supposed to do now? Is she supposed to bake pies, feeling the way she does? Hers is the tougher road to hoe, I think.
Tom?
Yes?
Can you speak to, let's get back to the poet. He did lose a son, a grown son.
He lost kids. He lost a kid to cholera at a very young age, and the relationship between him and his wife, Eleanor, was very, very much like this. They had a tough time all their lives, and indeed it was some experiences like this that prompted her to be a very pessimistic person, not a believer at all. She was, and he was. And if there was one conflict between them, it was that this kind of experience, it's more complicated than that, but as much as anything, the catalyst for her cynicism, she was a real cynic, was the death of their very young baby of cholera. And she never really got over it. And they had a long marriage, but it always had this schism. And it turned as much as anything on his continuing faith, because he was a faith, he was a man who believed. He was a Christian, and she was not. And so I see a lot of that in this poem, the division between them, which was lifelong, and tragic, terribly, very hard for both of them.
He was also, though, very abusive, Tom.
Oh, yes, he was.
It wasn't just a split of belief systems.
No, right. I only go when I'm the show. Is the amusing part of his ego, but he was an enormously egotistical, ambitious person, who's being the cynosure, being the center of attention, pushed everything else in his life aside. So he was extremely tough on her. He was extremely tough on his children.
I mean, the poem is interesting in that the mere physical proximity of the husband to the wife is a physical threat, is a threat. She shrinks from his arm on the banister near her. And the last line, and it's very poignant. I mean, they're both profoundly lonely, and you can feel deeply for each of them. But that last line is hardly a line of "I'm going to take charge here." It's a veiled threat of "If you leave, I'm going to drag you back by force." And the threat is, the implication is of abuse. And I think that shrinking from his mere physical presence is also indicative of the kind of abuse dynamics that's already occurred in the relationship, and his desperation for connection. Mm-hmm. Not knowing how to make that connection,
yeah,
and wanting to force it.
Yeah. Yes.
Further Jan. To that, I think, you know, the first, I think it's, I need to thing in front of me to really do anything with it, but I think her first emotional reaction is described as fear, that she's looking back over her shoulder and seeing this grave, and what she's experiencing initially is fear. And I've been puzzling over why fear for a while, but what you said there, I mean, it's the fear is probably what she has to conclude about him.
Yeah, that may be in there. I must say, apart from Frost himself, I don't sense it as an abusive relationship. It may start to be here, but it seems to me he's going a long way. Maybe we have a little war between the sexes taking place here. Maybe. Because I feel sympathy with him trying to relate to her. I don't think he's ever threatened her before. I don't sense it. Maybe I'm wrong about this. And Frost was not physically abusive to his wife, but he was a tough, strong man, and he was very difficult to live with. And that's a kind of abuse carried to the extent, and I think Ruth is quite right to point that out. But here I sense the incipient problem between them, which may result in his being an abusive person, but I don't think he's been up to this point, and I think he's trying his darndest to work his way to her, and she's trying her darndest to work her way through what to her has been, her world is in flames. And she's terrified, I think, of dealing with the death of the child and what it's done to her. And looking at it reminds her of this almost madness that she feels.
I didn't necessarily mean that she was afraid of him physically abusing her, but that what she had seen of him and his nature, and what she had seen by extension of human nature through his reaction to this, may have been... I mean, I don't think... If I was looking at the grave of my child, I would experience fear because of that death. I think her fearful reaction would have been fear in reaction to what she had seen, that she had now to conclude about the character of her husband and about the character of her friends and about the mm-hmm. character of human beings in general. Mm-hmm. That's what she now saw as fearful. She was mm-hmm. afraid of life.
Yeah, I think she's very young. She's very young, and this has been more than she can deal with as a young person. I suspect it may be the first such experience. Yes?
I keep feeling a sympathy for him, and I think that when he said that to her at the end, that he would bring her back by force, that he was up against the wall. He tried to talk with her, reason with her. And that was sort of the last resort. He didn't know where to go from then, so the fact that he couldn't do anything by talking with him, and he thinks, well, then I'll do this, you know, kind of like, what else could he do?
Yeah.
But he wanted her back, and so that would be the only thing that he could think of at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. Perlon.
Well, even if he would have, if he, you know, would have resorted to force, it seems to me the fact that if he wanted them to keep it quiet, since whoever was coming up the road, he wouldn't have done anything since whoever was coming up the road.
I think that's right.
I mean, that would have, even if he didn't want people, like, if he didn't want them to see him arguing, he certainly didn't want them to see him.
I think that's indicated. I think that's really indicated in the little stage directions that our actors were working with, in that he says, where are you going? I will come and get you. And I think the reason he's not going to hold her there is because there's somebody coming. That's just my thinking about how it would play. I think he would not hold her there while somebody's coming up the walk, but he would go and get her and bring her back, perhaps by force. Yes.
Don't you think, too, this may have been something she had witnessed throughout his life, and then it really climaxed when she saw the same scenario about the callous way that he dealt with the death, and all of a sudden it was like all the, maybe the year they'd been together or whatever, came shooting back at her, and so she really knew what was happening. And she felt, well, this is his callousness, this is his, he doesn't care about relationships, or he doesn't...
His masculinity.
Yeah, it's yeah. Just like this performance is the main thing, you know, and it's like, who, you know, this is another function, let's bury this baby and let's get on with everything.
Get on with life, yeah.
Yeah, and let's just be married and happily married, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, then she just, you know, then it was like she lost it.
Yeah.
Forget
yeah.
this. What is this
yeah.
guy?
Yeah, it's really a male-female kind of yeah. crunch, isn't it?
Yeah.
His obtuseness as a male, her inability to see his pragmatic approach to the world as what, if you're a New Hampshire farmer on one of those rock-strewn farms, you've got to be a pretty pragmatic person. You're not gonna make it. You know? You're going to have to go out to Ohio or someplace.
Well, I think she wanted warmth in the dialogue that he had with her. He probably was not capable of that. Although at the one moment, I did feel he was really reaching out and saying, you know, I don't know how to say what you want, or
yeah.
but I'm going to try.
Yeah, man must give up his manhood in order
yeah,
to relate
I,
to a woman.
I think probably this had gone on for a while, and he really wasn't, didn't have a training or wasn't capable of the kind of warmth that she needed.
Yeah, not yet anyway. Maybe they'll work their way through. I sensed a little optimism here earlier that they were going to make it. I'm now sensing a little more pessimism. Phyllis.
I don't know if this is quite the male-female reaction, but I had kind of an interesting experience with some of this. And I was fairly young. I was on my internship, so I was early 20s. And it was the first being in any kind of ministerial role that I had been in with a funeral. And I didn't know the people real well, but I felt very sympathetic and tried to be very involved. And there was just that sense of, what does it mean to reverence life and death? And then I remember, you know, we got in the hearse, and it was the undertaker, the senior pastor, and myself, and then the hearse with the body in the back. And so then we drove out to bury this body. And, you know, the family was in the car and around. And as soon as we got in the car, and, you know, and all this reverent getting the body in, and closing in, slowly getting into the car. And as soon as the doors closed, we turned on, you know, the driver turned on the ball game, and well, you know, and then they were talking about the ball game, and, you know, well, so-and-so, and then, boom, turn it off. And then we did did the prayers and laid the body to rest, and, you know, hugged the crying people and got back in the car. Ball game. That was just very strange for me. It was like, my goodness. I mean, that just didn't, that wouldn't have been the way that I would have with my choices then in that moment, and yet it was, so I don't know what was happening with that, but it was very interesting.
Your reaction is female. Let me give you a male reaction. Do you happen to remember the score of all of that?
To this was on an Indian reservation. It was a funeral, and I was gone for the day and just came back late in the afternoon, and the grave had been dug, the funeral had been, and the casket was in the ground, but it hadn't been covered. And it was a pretty, it wasn't a real fancy, and then it had just been dug, and so we felt that we needed to cover it before sunset, and in terms of Indian tradition, and just in terms of reverence, that felt important. And so it was the other pastor and I who, and I hadn't even met this person who had been buried, and it was a military funeral, so that there was a nameplate, a brass nameplate on this wooden coffin that was in the ground, and so we were shoveling this gravel, dirt background, you know, in this clump. Mm-hmm. And then once that had been covered, it was just the sound onto the earth, which wasn't quite as eerie. But I noticed that neither one of us wanted to cover the nameplate. Mm-hmm. And I was like, which one of us was going to be the first one to cover that identity? And that was very interesting. It was sort of like that was the respective face. And it was up on the top where the face was me. And so it was very interesting where that thud went.
Yeah. Don't mean to cut off the discussion of this at all. I thought maybe it would be good to end on a slightly more upbeat note. So, I want to read to you a lovely, well, I've only got a couple of minutes, so it's got to be short. So I'm going to read this short poem on page 258. This is fairly clear and self-explanatory, and I've just got time to read it. Then we can discuss it maybe tomorrow if you like. It's called Goodbye and Keep Cold. The saying goodbye on the edge of the dark and the cold to an orchard so young in the bark reminds me of all that can happen to harm an orchard away at the end of the farm. All winter, cut off by a hill from the house, I don't want it girdled by rabbit and mouse. I don't want it dreamily nibbled for browse by deer. And I don't want it butted by grouse. If certain it wouldn't be idle to call, I'd summon grouse, rabbit, and deer to the wall and warn them away with a stick for a gun. I don't want it stirred by the heat of the sun. We made it secure against being, I hope, by setting it out on a northerly slope. No orchard's the worse for the wintriest storm, but one thing about it, it mustn't get warm. How often already you've had to be told, keep cold, young orchard, goodbye and keep cold, dread 50 above, more than 50 below. I have to be gone for a season or so. My business a while is with different trees, less carefully nurtured, less fruitful than these. And such as is done to their wood with an axe, maples and birches and tamaracks, I wish I could promise to lie in the night and think of an orchard's arboreal plight, when slowly, and nobody comes with the light, its heart sinks slower under the sod. But something has to be left to God. We'll pick this up tomorrow. Thank you.